kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode 89 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide podcast with me, Di Barnes, and...
Me, Doug Belshaw. How are you doing, Di?
I'm good, thank you, Doug, on this Wednesday evening past 9 o'clock. But I'm doing well. I've just been to a debate for that my boarding house was participating in, and everyone had to go and support. So I went to make sure they were in line, as it were, in the house. And it was very good. We won. The debate was on whether there should be an opt-out system rather than an opt-in system for donating organs. And we were opposing the motion and were victorious, for we were better researched.
Very good.
That's how it rolls. How about
you? I'm fine. We didn't record an episode last week because I was in Barcelona, which was, if you've been following the news, an interesting time to be there.
No, yeah, it's fascinating. We had a little chat trying to organise when we could do an episode, didn't we? And it was
we did a little
insight into your experience of being out there whilst the Catalonian independence drive is going on.
Yeah, so if you're listening to this and you've had your head under a rock, or you live in a part of the world that doesn't report European news, or indeed you're listening to this several years later, after Di and I have left this mortal coil, then the context is that there was an independence referendum the Sunday before last. And of the 42% of people who are eligible to vote, 42% of people voted. And of the people who voted, 90% voted in favor of Catalonian independence. Catalonia is a region of Spain which includes Barcelona. It's a very rich region, and they've been wanting independence for ages. I didn't realize that they're actually a separate nation, a bit like Scotland, but they don't really have the same kind of status, I don't think. Anyway, long story short, I arrived last Tuesday for a conference that I was speaking at, and I'll talk about that later. There was a general strike on that day, but I didn't have any problems getting a taxi. I spoke at the conference. There's all this stuff happening, like fever pitch kind of flags and signs and stuff everywhere, but very friendly, no kind of, you know, if it was in England, like with Brexit, you got animosity and that kind of thing. None of that. And then there was a rumor going around that they were going to declare independence on Friday, which was the day that my dad arrived for the weekend to join me in Barcelona. And they didn't. They didn't declare independence. And instead, there was a backlash by the pro-Spain anti-separatist movement. And on Sunday, my dad and I got caught up in a big protest, hundreds of thousands of people marching in favor of Spanish unity. So that was fun.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it, when you look at what's happened in our country. And it's a different affair when you think about the Scottish referendum. I guess it's the most comparable event rather than Brexit.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. But I was listening to the radio article on that this morning, I think, and they were saying, in relevance to education, that in schools, Catalonian is the language that is spoken in Catalonian schools, and that Spanish is only taught, has less curriculum time than English, and that therefore making Spanish just another, you know, foreign language and not the most important one, which gives you
and all the street signs and stuff are in Catalonian and Spanish. And there is actually, when you look at it, a reasonable difference between it. It's not just accent or whatever. Like, there is a bit of a difference between it. And they'd rather you spoke English to them rather than try to speak Spanish to them.
Well, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? And that's, I've heard that before. I've heard whisperings of that when I've only been to Spain twice, and once was to Madrid where this wasn't an issue. Once was just over the border. I was staying at Perpignan. We went to visit Spain for the day. You can see Salvador Dali's work, I believe. And and I remember someone talking to me, be careful, you know, because it's all that Catalan thing. And I didn't really know the history of it, but here the history is being spelled out quite concisely for me. But I have to say, though, I'm a bit surprised that if I was Spanish, if I was a Spanish and not Catalan, then and that Catalan didn't speak Spanish as much with as much priority as it did English. I'd be a little bit annoyed, you know. It's a next door country. It's a little bit silly It's just like, do you know what I mean? It's just seems to lack
but the
common
history,
sense.
No, but the history died because I didn't know the history, you see, and I've kind of been reading into it. You know, during Franco's reign, Catalonia
nice
was
man.
Brutally repressed. And, you know, Barcelona football team, which represents the region, it's more than a club. You know, it's got in the seats Mesca, Un Club, whatever it says. Like, it's a big deal that, you know, this kind of region was repressed and has managed to forge its own identity. And in fact, if you took the economy of Catalonia and compared it against other EU countries, it would, you know, they're richer per capita than a lot of EU countries. So it's an interesting state of affairs. And the really interesting thing for me was that I was reading kind of English news because I didn't speak Spanish or Catalan. And the news I was getting through was not reflecting what I was seeing on the ground. I was reading about how fascists were bussing people, the far right were bussing people in, and there were Nazi salutes and stuff. And I saw nothing like that. And of course, I can only see what I can see with my own eyes. But the people I saw getting on and off buses were coming in to protest in Barcelona in a very friendly way. There were families, they were giving out stickers which had the Catalan, Spanish, and European flag on it. Everyone's very friendly. There was a bit of a standoff at one point, but they weren't like shouting obscenities at each other. They were just kind of demonstrating the fact they're on different sides. And I have to say that if it was in England, it would be completely different.
Well, I think, possibly. I think, I mean, there are many peaceful protests have gone on in England, and I used to participate in them often once upon a time.
These are nationalist
ones. The nationalist ones.
Yeah, and the EDL would be there. There'd be alcohol involved, and there was none of that. Yeah. So anyway, that was really interesting. And then,
well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out as well.
Yes, because on Monday, just to finish off the arc of that story, the leader of the Spanish government, of the Catalan government, was expected to declare unilateral independence and didn't. And I think that was a wise move, given what I heard on the ground. So
yes. And the sort of unity movement is getting its stuff into gear, isn't it? So
yes,
we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting.
Yeah. So what did you do last week while I was doing all that?
Since we were last talking, I've published a website called Get Stuff Done, which is made by the Digital Leaders on a Google site. And it's tech advice for pupils by pupils for other people in the school, as it were. And so that was really good. It's good fun. They've done a good job, I think, and worked hard at it as a team, which has been really nice. So that's that. I've been setting up on a barefoot walk sponsored. So I'm going to India on Boxing Day with a group of 20 pupils. And we've talked about this before. I've been when I went out to do a recce for it. And we're going to be building some houses out there, and the children are going to be doing some painting and things like that. Although visas are very hard to do if you're going to go and do charitable work. It's very hard to get visas if you mention the word work at all to go to India at the moment, to the extent that some schools have been turned away at the airport.
Really?
And sent home, yeah, very seriously.
So why is that? Is that a political thing or what's going on there?
I don't know. There are some sort of political issues going on, but I'm not 100% sure what they are. It's not my trip, so I've not really been dealing with it. So that was fun. So I did the walk anyway, on a 10K walk they're going to do, and they're going to get sponsored per kilometre, and it's going to be a real challenge because they're going to be barefoot. It's going to be November.
Whereas for you, it's a walk in the park.
It is exactly that. So it was a pleasure to walk, although there's, you know, lots of different surfaces and nettles and thistles and things. So that should be fun. So we're going to do a little bit of training with the children and then go and do it, and hopefully maybe get some parents to come and do the walk whilst we're walking as well. That kind of thing. So that should be good.
You put something in here about... I had a question about your Get Stuff Done website. I'm a big fan of working openly, but given that it's talking about specific things of your school network, why have you chosen to make that public?
Only for ease of use. There's no particular reason to keep it secret, I don't think.
No kind of things which, well, I mean,
I mean, there's URLs on there about remote access and things like that.
The only thing I would say is that if you think about the attack surface of your school network, you're giving people a bit more insight into how your school network works.
That's yeah, but that's all of these things are available publicly.
Yeah, cool.
There's nothing on that.
I'm just linked to publicly. If you see what I mean. Just for the benefit of other people who might want to do it. I think it's great that you're working openly. It's good.
Well, that's what I thought. I mean, I did think about that because it's a Google site, so you could get it locked down. But really, I think that, especially in the first days or, you know, the first iteration of its life, for the website to be open just means people can go and click on it and see it without having to sign in. And that might be actually quite a good thing to do. Just to give it some life and get some fingerfall or eyefall through it. And then we'll have a look at that. I mean, I did think about the points of, you know, that our SSL URLs are there. But if anybody wants to go and find, all of those things are linked to anyway, out there on the web. Right. So it's not a big deal. There are other things like the structure of usernames are in there as well and things like that, which, you know, if you were trying to hack, then to get into our systems in some way, that might be helpful.
Going back to the barefoot walking, you've put another article alongside that about medieval life.
So I don't wear shoes to walk, so I started running barefoot, and now I walk barefoot everywhere. And it's walking is a greater skill than running, which is a bit odd. There's a lot of stuff out there about learning how to run barefoot, but I found that sort of, I mean, you have to learn, but it's, but walking is a thing that I forget to do correctly more often. This guy, So this guy is like a historian who's turned his hand to the footwear of medieval times, where they were much like thick leather socks, and so that people walked differently, and you walked on your the balls of your feet. So he calls it ball walking, and it's just
quite ball funny. Walking, yeah.
Indeed, it's quite funny, but it's quite serious at the same time. Yeah. And in my opinion, you know, I think shoes are evil. So there we go.
So it's talking about touching your toe, and there's a video here which I haven't watched, but it says, quote, if you touch your toe to the ground first, you can always lift your leg back up and avoid stepping down harder on that sharp rock or snake. But if you hit the ground with your heel first, it's harder to jump back. End of quote.
Yeah, so your heels are essentially your brakes in the human mechanics, I would argue. And I think that's correct, although it's actually more complicated than that, in my opinion. So this guy is not a very experienced barefoot walker, but it's quite an entertaining sort of way in. So what you're actually doing, so your foot, when it hits the floor, I would never strike the floor with my toe first. It would always be the ball of my foot. And that is quite a broad surface, and you can adjust that very quickly if something is uncomfortable or is feeling like it's going to be dangerous to your foot. You can adjust the weight of that, or indeed not put any weight onto it at all, and kind of do a funny hopping thing.
It says that people who walk in this way, like yourself, I guess, have awesome calf muscles. Is this true?
I've never really been able to judge my own calf muscles. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those things.
Other people have told me that your calf muscles.
Well, this is it. Could you please tell me about my calf muscles? I remember thinking my dad had impressive calf muscles, and I don't think he walked barefoot much. So I'm quite a sort of stocky build. My calves are well built, but so are other bits of me. And contrastingly, other bits not so well built. I don't know what the answer is, Doug. Okay.
Right, moving swiftly on. Tell me about the next thing. You've put something in here about rubber duck debugging.
Well, we started doing our NEA since we last spoke, my fifth form, my year 11s, which is a non-examined assessment, like a controlled assessment, but under a new specification. So it's a new thing. It's quite a controversial piece, actually. It's something we could talk about in depth at some point, but we'll not do that today. Because it's quite difficult to achieve and very different to the previous iteration of this method of assessment. So we have 20 hours to the minute for the children to do this piece of work, which is quite a complex programming task, which they have to document thoroughly at the same time. My colleague mentioned to me, Rob Cunniff, hello, Rob, if you're listening, you're probably not, that there was a debugging method called rubber ducking. So when the children get stuck, they're not allowed to ask us for any help. They have a folder of resources they have access to on these lockdown accounts. There's no internet access. And in that folder, we put loads of stuff. They can put what they want in there before it begins, and then we can put what we want in there before it begins, and the backups have a snapshot of what's in the folder for the board. Mm. And so there's loads of stuff in there, but really what they need to do is to talk it through. So I'm forever giving them like notebooks to work in, just to scribble on, and we have boards with pens so they can just doodle when they hit a problem and trying to work out how to solve it. And then Rob told me about this thing called rubber ducking, right? And I thought, what? And essentially you get a rubber duck and you talk to the rubber duck and explain the problem to the rubber duck. And as you're explaining it out loud to an inanimate object, it strikes you what the answer possibly could be. And he told me it's a real thing. So he sent me this video, which led me to the website rubberduckdebugging.com. And so that's the link in there. So what we're going to do is purchase loads of rubber ducks, which are cheap as chips. And we're going to give one to each of the children who are doing this, this NEA. And they're going to get to pimp their rubber duck. It's going to be cool. So they're going to get to get a rubber duck and sort of personify it in some way.
Is this like a throwaway domain? Is this like a...
I don't know what it is.
No. What I mean, like, do they need the domain to be persistent for a very long time?
Rubber duck debugging?
No, sorry. I thought you said you were going to give the domain name to the...
No, not the domain
student.
Name. We're going to give a rubber duck... An actual rubber duck.
Oh, sorry. Right.
And inanimate with a yellow body and a red beak. Catch up.
Right. And sorry.
And so that they get one each and they get to go and make it into what they want.
Right.
Domain is owned by whoever's invented rubber duck debugging. So I put that on Facebook and I got responses from Pat Parslow. Hello, Pat, if you're listening. And Logan Evans, who's Pat is a computer programming lecturer at I can't remember where, and
he was at Reading, so
okay, might still be there. And Logan works for Google, whom I've talked about before. I went to see him in Mountain View last a year ago or so, whenever I went to San Francisco. So he said he's actually used this method. It's quite funny. So,
I have heard it mentioned, but I didn't know what it was.
That's the thing. But it's quite good fun. So we're going to buy rubber ducks for all the kids that are doing this, and then they get to, have their rubber duck and put their name on it.
It's a nice workaround, isn't it? I mean, that's a good thing.
Oh, it's always just fun. I don't know if it'll do any good, but it'll at least be a sort of lighthearted thing to do in the middle of this very serious, very long assessment. And then the other thing I've been doing, we've done long tutorials this week in response to comments teachers have shared, just internally, they don't go home, and with my tutees, and a couple of them were addressing their maths and they're getting used to A-level work. So I was talking about ways that they could, spend their time wisely to go over topics that they haven't quite got the better of in class, up to now in the first 6 weeks of term. So I talked to them about the Khan Academy and I talked to them about Wolfram Alpha, and they'd never heard of them. This is three or four different tutees and never heard of these sites. Wow. And I thought, wow, okay. And it just reminded me of the importance you just assume that people will be sharing things, like teachers will be sharing really good sites. Mm. So like all math teachers would say, here's Wolfram Alpha, here's Khan Academy, these are things that you can use to support your work, but they don't. And
it's really interesting, isn't it? Like communication and discovery and all that kind of stuff, the things that we take for granted, like you said. So I went from Barcelona to Geneva, to the International School of Geneva. So hello to anyone listening who is listening to this as a result of me being there. They have got a fantastic school, one-to-one laptops, doing wonderful things. But they asked me to come across to do a very lightweight audit of what they could be doing next in terms of their staff, student, parents. I spoke to different classes, without any teachers being there, talked to the students. I talked to a group of parents. I talked to, staff, principals, etc. And again, like any organization, the better the communication is, the better the outcomes are. And so I spoke to people who are outside of my comfort zone for recommending things like modern foreign languages. Mm-hmm. And I just did really quick searches of stuff that I've never come across before. So like, how do you take something like Duolingo, but make it more appropriate for the classroom? And I just did some searches, and you forget the fact that you've got better search skills than other people because you're spending your whole life on the internet. And you assume that people are sharing these things with one another, or that, you know, people are finding out things through Twitter and other social networks, but quite often they're not. And yeah, it's absolutely right, isn't it?
And the thing is that I know some stuff about maths that other teachers don't or don't think is a priority, but actually the children find it really helpful. So I went to find on Khan Academy, for example, one of my students was struggling with kinematic equations, which I didn't even know what they are. So I went and found these, which took me a little while on the Khan Academy. It wasn't easy. But once I'd found my way, I went and found them just to show that, he could use these to go over kinematic formulas in his holiday. And he's a very willing student, straight A's in his maths AS level, now in upper six, but he really doesn't like this area of the work. So, I thought it was a good thing anyway. So I included it in here. So that's what I've been up to this week. What else have you been doing other than Barcelona?
So I was in Geneva, which was great. And Richard Alloway and the principal, Jim, they took me out for fondue. I've never had fondue before. And
no way. Did you have raclette?
What does that mean?
Cheese fondue.
Yeah, cheese fondue. Yeah, so a big kind of pan. And they do the thing at the end where, the stuff which is stuck to the bottom, they scrape it off, and it's called the religios or something.
Okay.
And that was amazing. We're dipping the bread in and stuff. And they said, you're going to get the cheese sweat. And I did work on the middle of the night, sweating cheese. And apparently you're not supposed to drink beer with it, because then it coagulates, as opposed to drinking wine where it breaks it up. So, yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. I must drink more wine. I like my cheese. Yeah.
Oh. But just going back to Barcelona, actually. So I was speaking at a conference called the All Digital Conference. And it used to be known as the Telecenter Conference. And Telecenters were set up 10 years ago, so it was the anniversary. Uh-huh. And it's grown like topsy, really kind of grown quickly. And there's thousands and thousands of these centers throughout Europe, digital competence centers. So the people come from all over Europe to this extremely well-run event. It was really fantastic. Like, the buses were there when you needed them. Everything ran to time. And it was just really friendly. And everybody obviously got on well and treated each other like family almost. Mm-hmm. But I was going to, you have to plan this in advance, and you're asked what you're going to speak about, like, weeks or months in advance. And so in the conversation that I had with the organizers, who'd found me via, my TEDx talk on YouTube, by the way, I said I was going to talk about future mindsets, skill sets, and future kind of architecture, like how we're going to deal with it. And I was going to talk about smart cities, but in the end, I thought, well, given I saw this tweet about how the Catalonian government were finding it really difficult to keep their domain name and keep the websites up because they were being clamped down on so hard by the Spanish government. And so I ended up doing this presentation about kind of decentralization, about things like IPFS, which is known as the Interplanetary File System, ZeroNet, BitNation, all that kind of stuff. And just kind of linked it really closely to what was going on in Catalonia, saying that I didn't have enough knowledge of Spanish politics to be able to make a decision as to whether Catalonian independence was a good thing, but I was really interested in the technology. And that went down really well. I talked about open badges. I talked about digital literacies. And as I always do now when I'm invited to speak at a conference, I always run a workshop as well, because I think that just doing a... And also I stay for the entire thing, because I feel like flying in, like dumping a few slides on people and then flying out is almost rude,
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So loads of people came to the Open Badges workshop. I've had follow-up emails of people who are going to be using badges for digital competence in Romania and all the other places. So it went down really, really well. And I've kind of written a follow-up blog post called Decentralized Technologies Mean Censorship Resistant Websites. Have a look at that if you're interested.
Okay, I've not read that. I will pay attention. You just mentioned your TED talk, and that reminded me that Amy Burville has made a YouTube version of her TED talk and put it up on YouTube, which is called Get Smart Lessons from the Artist. Did you manage to see this?
Yes, so I watched that a couple of weeks ago when I was in Brighton, I think I was, and it's absolutely fantastic.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Well done, Amy, because it's yeah, I just think there's lots to learn from artists, and you kind of see artists as enigmas of great talent and things like that. And Amy breaks down the sorts of things that they used to do and quotes from them and how they did their work. I mean, it's really, really fascinating.
And you know, if it was a podcast like this and you were just listening to the audio, that would be like, it's so well written that you'd gain so much from just the audio. But you know, she does these, and I think she draws them on her phone, these amazing drawings.
Yes.
Yeah. And a bit like, you know, Brian Mothers, who I've just been speaking to before recording this podcast, you know, Amy's, she was already good, but just seeing the development is amazing. And on Sunday, I was at the Picasso Museum with my father, with my dad. Mm-hmm. And even though we know that kind of genius is not like a wing and a prayer and you're just born with it, you know, it takes hard work. But I didn't know much about Picasso's early life, and I didn't know about his dad, you know, being a lecturer in art, and, you know, him starting at a really young age, like painting amazing things and putting them in against, you know, mature adult artists at the age of 13 and stuff. And just seeing the way that they set it out, I don't know if you've been to that museum, but the way they set out the story of his life and different phases and how he changed when he met people is absolutely fascinating. I think Amy gets to some of that in her video.
Yeah, it reminds me of something else, actually, that I've been doing UCAS references this week, because we have the deadline for our UCAS applications was Monday. And so I've been tidying those up and doing lots of personals, helping the students with their personal statements. And one of my tutees who's applying for economics, no, another one that's doing government and politics, was talking about Jeremy Paxman's book, which was post his retirement from BBC, presenter on the BBC, of Newsnight. And it mentions how so many politicians, those who are in senior positions, have childhood trauma. And it's uncanny, and yet the number, it was just a sort of really interesting insight. And I've not gone and researched it any further than the fact that he mentioned it, but I thought that was really interesting as they navigate our way through modern life, that their choices are undoubtedly influenced by their own experiences of what society is, etc. And and it's not a dissimilar thing, possibly.
No, definitely. And I think, you know, trying to understand art, and Amy in that presentation, you know, uses a lot of reasonably famous examples, but goes into a bit more depth about, I think it was, you know, Marcel Duchamp's urinal, and, you know, is it art, etc. And, you know, I did philosophy of art at university and that kind of thing. But you need the biography of the person. And I feel like one of the things that, as I'm getting older, like I talk about context a lot, but knowing the context and where people are coming from, and the biography of people and organizations is really important. You know, knowing the position from which people are coming from and what they're aiming for as well. So, you know, I read a story on Medium, and I'm not going to be able to find it quick enough to put it in here, but a guy who I know from when I used to hang out at Campus North in an accelerator, and he wrote a blog post about this time last year, where I had no idea, because I haven't seen him for a couple of years. He ended up in hospital just being like properly burned out and really seriously ill. And he was reflecting on, you know, venture capital and accelerators and all this kind of stuff. And he wants to make it a lot more ethical and a lot more family oriented and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's the structure of the organization, in the same way that the art world is structured in a certain way, and technology is structured in a certain way, and schools are structured in a certain way. And I think we need to pay a lot more attention to that in general.
I think so. Another point as well. So I watched a film this week called Frida, based on Frida Kahlo's life. You're starring Selma Hayek. I think it was made in 2002. And she is Selma Hayek is extraordinary in it. But Frida Kahlo, who is one of the artists in Amy's talk, is absolutely fascinating. So is it Trotsky came over and stayed with them, and he was assassinated in Mexico?
Oh, with an ice pick, yes.
And he stayed at Frida Kahlo's house, not when he was assassinated. He left there after an assassination attempt was made. He left the house and then was assassinated elsewhere. But absolutely a fascinating life.
And doesn't Doesn't Theresa May, given that, you know, she's supposed to have the obsession with shoes and fashion, although
that's right, yes,
yeah, doesn't she count her as a role model, and they couldn't be more opposed in politics.
Well, this is exactly right. You know, so Frida Kahlo was communist, socialist, whatever, and I think in Theresa May's dreadful speech at the Tory party conference, which was full of too many things to mention, she was wearing a Frida Kahlo bracelet, so she was putting Frida Kahlo on her wrist while she was saying things in exact opposition to what Frida Kahlo would say,
it's appropriation. Yeah, I mean, appropriation, right, of the worst kind as well. I think that leads us nicely actually into, so it's been a couple of weeks, so I've put some links in here that I've shared in my Thought Travel newsletter, and you've put some stuff in here as well. It's a blog post by a guy who I've come across only this year, Benjamin Dockstader, and I think we've talked about some of his stuff before. He really goes into bat against people like Tom Bennett and Carl Hendrick and David Didow and people like that. Uh-huh. I really like his post because he researches really well. I think he's doing a PhD at the moment. I'm not entirely sure. But he talks about innovation.
What does this post say? I've not read this, so go on.
Well, he's talking about innovation. It says, the idea of innovation comes with its own history. Benoit Godin traces how the word shifted from a pejorative to its current status as a term of praise. Interestingly, the concept was linked with social change before it came to be used alongside the word technological. And so it's really talking about when we're saying about innovation, like, who is it an innovation for, and what does that mean in practice? And he ends it by saying, I'm all for purposeful experimentation driven by deeper values. If we really want our kids to love reading, then why not experiment and let kids choose their own books? Maybe try out graphic novels and assemble a more challenging and diverse collection of literature. There's nothing innovative about giving a child a graphic novel or letting them read an engrossing book that happens to have some sex and swear words, but it might just create a reader out of someone who had given up hope. And what's better than that? And it's talking about, like, what is innovation, basically.
Yeah, well, that strikes a real chord with me, because for all the educational innovations that are going on, the thing I find myself saying to the pupils I work with, in both in class and in the boarding house, is that if you are really worried about... So the pace of work here is quite tough for a boarder, particularly because they only have a certain amount of times when they can do their own work. I said, if you're really worried about it, I said, you need to read. I said, read, and then read some more. And that will help you. You know, you've got another, so for our 14-year-olds, they have another 9 years of education in front of them, potentially. And they need to get on it. You know, they need to really be good at processing words, at writing, at being able to absorb and synthesize and make connections. So I talked about the sort of Daniel Willingham principles of general knowledge being the greatest catalyst of learning. It allows you to learn faster because you're essentially filling in the gaps of whatever you're learning with your own knowledge. And it sort of is like a jigsaw puzzle kind of thing fitting in together. And so I've been really pushing just that one basic principle: get reading. Doesn't matter what you read, just get reading and enjoy it. Get good at it.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I need, one of the things that I'm finding difficult at the moment is to, you know, I talk a lot about working 4 days a week, and I haven't been able to do that for weeks, if not months, which is great because I'm in demand and I've got lots of work on. But at the same time, it means I don't get that chance to read as much, and certainly reading in depth and reading, instead of the articles that I'm sharing here, which are great, reading books, which are people having to spend time really distilling their thoughts and having gone through an editing process and then it going out for mass kind of consumption. There's something about that as well.
Yeah, so there's a thing about reading. There are all sorts of different books out there, aren't there, and different ways of reading. But that's something that I don't get. You know, all the reading that I do during term time is connected to my lesson planning or my capacity to talk about the relevant topics of the day. So be it privacy, be it different software development, or whatever, And so I'm looking forward, I break up on Saturday for a 2-week half term. So I'm looking forward to reading Infinite Jest over the holiday, which is a mighty, mighty book.
Oh, that's by David. Who's that by?
I don't remember. I haven't read it yet. So
it's the guy who died and who killed himself in his 30s, isn't it? Yeah.
No, I don't know much about it. I'm just going to go and have a look at it. So one of my children is having a lot to do with it. David Foster Wallace. And
yes.
And it's North American dystopia. Lengthy and complex work, says Wikipedia. So I'm gonna take that on and have a go at that over the holiday. Cool. See what happens.
Have you seen Blade Runner yet?
Is there a new Blade Runner? Sorry, I really should be better at this. Is there a new Blade Runner out?
There's new Blade Runner 2049. I haven't seen it yet, but it's supposed to be amazing. So yeah, perhaps we should both go and see that and compare notes.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Talking about dystopia.
Is it on at the cinema now?
Yeah, it came out last weekend.
Okay. There's a lovely dystopia article, since we're on the word, that you shared.
Did I?
This week.
Smart in Thought Shop?
Yeah. It's the Guardian article. Our minds can be hijacked. Tech insiders who fear a smartphone dystopia. Is that the guy who'd invented the like button for Facebook? Is that article?
Yeah, this article is, you know, reasonably long one. It's talking about people who have worked for companies like Facebook and Google and whatever, and have got to the stage where they've got kids themselves. And, you know, famously, I think Steve Jobs didn't give his own kids iPads, did he?
That's right.
And it's that kind of thing, realizing that, okay, in the first, everyone responds to incentives. So they managed to create stuff. And I think they interview one person who created the, you know, we know when you drag the screen down to refresh.
Mm-hmm. For Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, it was for Twitter. It was a third-party Twitter app. They invented that. And the reasons for doing so were just almost entirely benign, or they were responding to the incentives of that particular thing that they were trying to solve. But the impact of it has been turning us all into, you know, pigeons tapping at a keyboard or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Yeah.
The way that they're trying to do something to lessen the damage of the stuff that they've invented.
No, this is it. So the guy who did the Facebook like button is called Rosenstein. He says it is very common for humans to develop things with the best of intentions and for them to have unintended negative consequences. But also in this article, he talks about how much development has done, how many conferences and that sort of thing there are on how to make your apps, your services compelling and addictive. But then it also is, and that's absolutely right. It's and I think you have another post in the thought was in Thought Shrapnel that we're going to talk about, which is about the idea of course these tech companies are doing that. Why would they do anything else? If you wanted, you know, if you went to the baker and they didn't bake the sweetest, most delicious cakes, which aren't good for you, you'd be disappointed. You don't, you know, you expect a baker to be doing that. It comes down to the individual's self-discipline and choices, you know, motivation gene, as it were, that needs to be there.
Yeah, the thing about Rosenstein, it says Rosenstein, the Facebook-like co-creator, believes there may be a case for state regulation of psychologically manipulative advertising, saying the moral impetus is comparable to taking action against fossil fuel or tobacco companies. If we only care about profit maximization, he says, we'll go rapidly into dystopia.
Yeah, that's it. And he looks at it, so he's 34 years old at the moment, so, but he's banned himself from Snapchat because he compares it to heroin. You get other people who give over. I think somebody else mentioned this article has given over their social media management to junior employees so that they don't have to be bothered by it and distracted by it. But this is a really interesting thing about how you manage your technology and making sure that you do manage it and not. He quotes the Biggie Small lyrics, doesn't he? From the youth about
don't get high on your own supply. Yeah,
don't get high on your own supply. That's the deal.
Yeah,
and they're talking about it like that. But everyone needs to have an awareness of that. I think it's really, really important.
You mentioned the article from The Intercept, which is entitled "Stop Expecting Facebook and Google to Curb Misinformation. It's Great for Business," by a guy called Sam Biddle, and it's in the wake of the American massacre in Las Vegas, which is, you know, the worst in history. But it talks about how, you know, really sensationalism, getting people to click on your stuff, is great for business. And so you can't really expect them to do something which isn't great for business. And I was thinking about this earlier. You know, there's been a massive long debate. You know, you get the big long threads on Twitter. You don't really get such long threads on Mastodon or Social Corp, the bit that I'm on. Mm-hmm. But there's been a really long one on, I think Mozilla gave, Rise Up, which is a anti-fascist kind of social collective. Mozilla gave them $100,000 to secure their communications network. But Rise Up is part of the Antifa kind of collective, which is actually named by the FBI as a terrorist organization. And it's really interesting. So you've got people who don't really know the history of all this. And of course, I haven't done, you know, I'm not American. I haven't read loads of, I know some of the history. I don't know all of it. But people who just make snap judgments, they're on the right of politics and really kind of going for it and having these long, uninformed debates. And people saying, like, look, this space here that we've created on Mastodon, decentralized network, etc., this is a space for reasoned debate and people knowing what they're talking about. It's not like Twitter. And I thought it was really interesting the way they set up the demarcation between, look, Twitter's over there for, you know, if you want to feed everyone your data and if you want to, like, just say stuff which is inflammatory so you get lots of likes and retweets and whatever, and you know, you might be able to monetize your tweets in some way. Like, piss off over there, basically, because here this is different. Yeah,
you can go back there. Going back to the Guardian article about smartphone addiction, they look at a gentleman called Eyal Harris, I think it is, something like that. And and he was a student who went rogue, whistleblower of sorts, lifting the curtain on the vast powers accumulated by technology companies and the ways that they are using that influence. He says, a handful of people working at a handful of technology companies through their choices will steer what a billion people are thinking today. He does a TED talk on it in Vancouver. Yeah. And it says, I don't know a more urgent problem than this. It's changing our democracy and it's changing our ability to have the conversations and relationships that we want with each other. And that's, you know, that's quite crazy. All began in 2013. He was working as a product manager at Google and circulated a thought-provoking memo. The memo is entitled, A Call to Minimize Distraction and Respect Users' Attention. And he only circulated it to 10 close colleagues. It struck a chord and spread to 5,000 employees, including senior executives who rewarded Harris with an impressive-sounding new job. He was to be Google's in-house design ethicist and product philosopher. But what happened is that it was that he was actually promoted into a marginal role. He was, you know, promoted out of harm's way.
Exactly. And
he got to sit in a corner and scratch his chin.
No, exactly. Like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, you get over there, out of the way of anyone who's doing any work.
That's it. Have this nice shiny office and a secretary, and we'll see you later.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you're young, you know, he's what, 33. And he says 2013, so he would have been in his late 20s at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's easy to go, oh my goodness, like Google is giving me this amazing role. But, you know, the people who are giving them the role in their late 40s, 50s are exactly understand what they're doing. And he gives examples, doesn't he, of, where does he say? He says about how LinkedIn exploits a need for social reciprocity to widen its network, YouTube, Netflix, autoplay videos. Snapchat creates his addictive snap streaks feature. That's what they do because people respond to incentives. And when you've got venture capitalists looking for an exit, you have to do the numbers.
Mm. So it's, a friend of Facebook told Harris, I'm quoting here, designers initially decided the notification icon, which alerts people to new activities such as friend requests, likes, should be blue. It fit Facebook style, et cetera, thinking when it would appear subtle and innocuous. But no one used it, Harris says. So they switched it to red. And of course, everyone used it because they discover that red, which that icon is now used everywhere for new activity, is a trigger color. It's an alarm signal. It brings people's attention in. They deal with it. They don't like having the red on their thing, whereas they like having the blue or whatever. You know, this doesn't bother them. So it's quite interesting just how our behavior is being manipulated. And it kind of goes back to Nudge and all of that book we've discussed before. where you're leading people's behavior by setting your default settings for everyone and default choices to the things that cause people to act.
Hmm. I think that's a nice link to an article which was shared by Stephen Downs in OL Daily, a website that I've never seen before called Three Quarks Daily. And it seems like to be a well-known website, like Richard Dawkins reads it and so do other people. And it's called Social Media and the Training of Our Minds by Samir Chopra. And it starts off with a bit of an anecdote, and they're walking down the street and someone almost bumps into them because they're so busy on their phone. And we've all experienced this. But they realize that their reaction to that is forming a tweet-sized update, which they're almost priming and getting ready so they can share that. And they're basically talking about how our minds are being played and distorted by the affordances and the framing of social media. I just thought it was a really interesting post. It says, so we're being asked by social media to make our interiority external, and we're happy to do so. There was a time when we needed to write the novel with its richly imagined interior mental spaces to enable this kind of introspection. Then came psychoanalysis with its couch and undirected free association. Now, Facebook status feed and your timeline offers access to these reports, all made available voluntarily. We log in, lie on our virtual couches, and chatter away. Here be novels and soliloquies and free associations indeed. End of quote.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's right, isn't it? It's about manipulated behavior underneath it all, manipulated thinking. Human beings naturally gather their thought from their peers. And if your peers is a social media channel of one sort or another, you have a distorted view of what is actually going on. So rather than actually talking, and that suggests that when you walk around your daily life and you talk to the people in that life, that you get a nice range of opinion rather than a kind of bubble of its own or a filtered set of opinions, which you're bound to get because you're operating within a set community, if you like, which is, I mean, it was back in the day, everything, you know, when I was a child, I was told to read all of the newspapers all of the time kind of thing, you know, not to stick with one, but to get a spread. And, you know, on Sundays, it was quite common for a family to buy three or four newspapers. And you could compare articles between the different publications. And that's still possible, but it's not. And I do try to do that. So I do try to subscribe to left-wing and right-wing papers so that I get an understanding of different articles and how they're being presented, different stories, how they're being presented. You know.
I've just been looking for, I just realized I thought we talked about this on the podcast, but there's a wonderful, wonderful post by Jonathan Worth. And Jonathan did a MOOC called Phonar, Phonar. Mm-hmm. And I think he was at Coventry and he's now at Newcastle Soul Centre. And he's a really interesting guy. I think Amy Burville, who you mentioned earlier, knows him quite well. And I think it was actually her who shared this post on our Slack channel called We Need to Talk About Vulnerability. I don't know if you saw this.
I haven't seen this, no.
Basically, he's talking about the kind of stuff that is in this Three Quarks Daily post. So in the Three Quarks Daily post, the one by Samir Chopra, who's a professor of philosophy at Brooklyn College, talks about the last paragraph of that one says, we're used to looking at older photos and exclaiming in surprise and wonder at how much we've changed. Those photographs have never captured the changes in our interiority. But a history of our social media interactions most certainly will. We might be surprised to see what we're becoming and have already become. And that links really nicely to what Jonathan's talking about in terms of the difference between capturing an image in analog versus capturing it in digital. It's a wonderful, wonderful post, which is difficult to actually take a quotation from because it really needs to be talked about in its totality, which is appropriate given what it's talking about. But it's a conversation I was having over fondue with Richard and Jamie, who are both keen photographers, and who have Richard certainly has gone back to film cameras because there's an artistry to it which you don't necessarily get when you're just using a huge memory card and an amazing digital camera. So I think maybe not talk about this particular post by Jonathan Worth now, but just put it into the show notes for people to have a look at if they're interested.
It's fascinating, the difference, like the idea that analog and digital photographs are very, very different, that one collects a latent image whilst the other just collects data.
Yes, yes.
There we go. Hmm. Interesting stuff.
It is.
I like to look at that free quarks. I might subscribe, I think. Looks like you get some interesting stuff from there.
I thought so. Yep, good stuff. Okay, where should we go next? There is another one on retreating from social media, if you want to keep on the theme.
Okay, let's do that. Digital learning side.
Yep, so this is a blog post on the Middlebury. While it's still loading here, there we go. And this is by Sonia Burrows, who is reflecting on a post, on a tweet from Sean Michael Morris. And Sean Michael Morris is the co-founder of Hybrid Pedagogy. And in his tweet, which she quotes, is Sean Michael Morris says, "I guess quitting Twitter is the new quitting Facebook. I did that once. Now age has made me moderate. Recede from Twitter like a hairline."
I buy that. I've been receding from Twitter for years, so I don't use it much at all, and I don't have as busy online interactive life as you do, and just because of the nature of my job, I guess. But but I have taken Facebook off my phone, so I rarely check it, and it's a pleasure not to check it, because what it makes you do, and this is a really interesting point about curating your experience of media, more information. Is that if you just go with that path of least resistance, you end up stuck down those grooves. But what I do now is I have to set up different channels. So, I do longer reading. I find different things from different places, and it's rewarding. It's a pleasure to go and do that rather than just accepting the daily trash that that you get sent in Facebook, which isn't all bad. You know, there were conversations on Facebook that I missed. Pat Parslow, for example, that is somebody I only know really through Facebook. And that's where he's active, and I've had lovely conversations with him, which are really, really relevant to digital education and to computer programming, because that's what he, you know, he's a much more seasoned professional than me in that regard. And so it's lovely to learn from him. It's interesting. It's not all bad in Facebook, but the point is there's just loads of trash in there.
No, that's right, and there's three reasons to recede from Twitter like a hairline, given in this post. And the first one is emotional well-being, and it's one of those things where unless you have, so one of the things at the International School of Geneva, which I was interested to explore with parents and with students because they have very different views, was the idea of having a digital detox, which you've talked about. And also there, between 12:30 and 2, they have a staggered lunch, and that covers that time period. They're not allowed any digital devices out in the cafeteria. And the cafeteria is like a central place of the school. It's almost like a massive glass box, this school. Mm-hmm. And so you don't realize until you do go cold turkey on things or have a forced period away from Twitter and Facebook and stuff, just how much it does affect your emotions. And I feel so much calmer now I'm not on Twitter. And I feel like I might miss some things, but it's worth it for it not affecting who I am in my core. We've talked before about how I feel that my natural state is quite centrist in politics, yet it makes me a lot more lurch to the left than I would be. And there's different elements of that, aren't there? Like you can be, I think some people talk about being fiscally conservative and socially, you know, more left wing or whatever it is, but it does have a real effect on you. Liberal. And the thing, more liberal. And I think the thing that has the most effect is just anger, and you should be cross about this thing and look at this, what's going on over here. And certainly my experience in Barcelona made me realize that very rarely are things as black and white as are reported in the media. And there's often a lot of nuance and shades of grey and uncertainty, etc. And so cutting out Twitter, and I cut out Facebook a long time ago of my life, has made I think, a net positive effect, because I still follow all the people I follow on Twitter. They can still get updates because I still post my blog post there. And I use tools like Nozzle, etc., to surface popular posts in that still extant community. Yet I'm spending a lot more time in places that, you know, I really care about, like Social Co-op, where I'm finding out about more about cooperative news and how people are working together to affect positive change, that kind of thing.
I know, I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't think, so my use of Mastodon anyway, and I dip in and out every week and several times a week usually and have a look. And there aren't usually many conversations of professional relevance to me going on in there, which I find difficult. I think the anxiety, if we just talk about the emotional part of Twitter for a moment, I think it's important to be, so I was just discussing with year nine pupils today, the idea of when people say things about you or your stuff that they don't like, they say unpleasant things, and how you should respond to that. And, you know, if someone's telling you, criticizing your shoes, it's usually because they don't like their own, or they feel insecure in some way about their own footwear, as indeed they should, because footwear is bad. And it's the same sort of thing. So when you're on Twitter, there is a sense of, am I missing out on something? Oh, I should see these things. And that's where Nozzle is really, really useful, because this sort of aggregator of things that people share, which quite often, you know, if you're processing tweets, you have to process the same tweet many, many times because people are sharing the same stuff. So Nozzle just allows the larger chunks to bubble to the surface, really. And
because it's showing all the links together, it allows you to see just how biased your network is. It really does.
Yes, no, because you can, yeah, absolutely, because you don't get to see the sort of detritus coming through. Your network is the things that your network is amplifying to you. That's what the bias that your network has. So none of the individuals within it, it's the network, it's the aggregated, the accumulated effect, and it allows you to identify some sort of bias in that and what people are talking about. Yeah, it's cool. So, I mean, I'm still using Twitter and I enjoy it. But I do use it very much through lists now. So I have specific lists, and I go to the lists which I have. So I have 10 columns set up in Hootsuite or TweetDeck or whichever tool. And those columns have different people in them, so I can watch what's going on and respond accordingly.
I've said this before, I think, that I've tried in the past to have more than just one link to people who I think are, you know, influence me in some way, or I have a connection with, etc. Mm-hmm. And I tried to do it through a spreadsheet once, but and there's a lot to be said about having an intentional approach to that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I feel like if that connection with the person is important or strong enough, then there are other ways. Like, it's my email address is not exactly hard to find on the internet. You know, places where you can get a hold of me, it's not exactly difficult. And I think that's true of lots of other people as well. So I'm not saying that I'm just saying, oh, well, I don't care about those people anymore. But I am kind of saying, well, sometimes I was paying attention to people and all of the small updates as well as the big important things they were doing. Almost by default, rather than actually I care about maybe three or four things that people are sharing or have done this year, as opposed to the thousands and thousands and thousands of updates you get from them.
Oh. I think it's, so tell me what you think about this then. So I feel in myself a desire to post certain thoughts in certain places. And this article is talking about why we feel the need to have our conversations publicly, which is what Twitter is doing and essentially what Facebook is doing too. So you might only be talking to one person, but everyone can see it, kind of thing. But I certainly feel, and that this is a new thing in me from when I started working online, this idea of sharing my thoughts about certain things publicly, which I find Mastodon is quite nice for, to be honest, in a certain way. I just kind of feel it's going to a smaller room, less people, and don't really care so much, which is quite pleasant. How do you feel about that? Because you're obviously a prolific publisher online, and sharing your thoughts.
Well, I have been. I don't think I am so much now, actually. I mean, if you look at the number of blog posts I've written in the last 6 months, it's decreased a lot. Number of tweets has gone off a cliff. And I'm spending a lot more... I'm spending a lot less time sharing raw thoughts, I would say.
Okay, that sounds about right. So tell me then, like, for example, when you take your black ops and you take your, you know, you're not doing social media, you're not writing blog posts, and that's, you've done that for a month at a time, or in sometimes 2 month chunks. Have you felt an emotional response in that, like, oh, I'd really like to get that out there, or I think that's worth getting out there, it's worth assembling into a post and sharing that, I must remember to do that? Or if you felt an urge to do that, or do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So in that blog post, Social Media and the Training of Our Minds, the Three Quarks one, the anecdote at the start about thinking about things in 140 characters, and obviously now I think Twitter's rolling out 280 characters, etc. But you realize that your thinking, your thoughts are structured in the way that the technology allows you to share them. Yeah? So even if it's not a character limit on Twitter, there are certain forms to the way that you write an email, or the way that you put an update in Slack, or whatever. Like, everything has its cultural way of doing. Exactly. So you end up, it's you know, the medium is the message. It ends up, we form our technology, and the technology then forms us. You know, it shapes us. I think there's a quotation, isn't there? We shape technology, technology shapes us. And that's the way that it works. So you, if you don't mix up the different technologies that you use, and if you don't have a break from them, then you end up being shaped by the very technology that you're trying to use to shape, to have a human impact in the world. And it's quite a difficult and nuanced and subtle thing to explain, and it's something that definitely needs to be experienced. But, you know, I am being shaped by what I'm doing on Mastodon and Social Co-op and Slack, and the way that I organize my working life in Trello and Google Calendar and all these kinds of things. And I keep referring to that Clay Shirky interview from a couple of years ago, where he said that he purposely tries to not have a completely honed workflow, and he gives up perfectly fantastic habits for awkward new ones and awkward new workflows, because he wants to keep himself on the edge and not too much in a particular mindset and a particular way of working.
Self-disruptive.
That's right, I wanted to link actually to a couple of things on this, because I think it's a really rich vein to mine. There's the Team Human podcast. Have you ever listened to that one with Douglas Rushkoff?
No.
Really interesting. So a lot of podcasts are structured the same way, and this one's slightly different. Douglas Rushkoff always does a monologue for the first 15, 20 minutes, and then he interviews someone. And sometimes the two bits are intimately connected, and sometimes they're not. And this one is so interesting because the two parts are very tenuously related, if at all, but they're both independently fascinating. So I actually wrote a very quick blog post on the second part of it, which is an interview with a guy called Arthur Brock on currency, which he breaks down into currency as in currency, but also current C as in current-see, as in the things we can currently see. And he says there's all different types of currency, and attention currency and everything like that, and how we can reclaim currency to allow people to see the way the world really is. So I highly recommend you listen to the second part of it. But the first part of it, Douglas Rushkoff, who's a very deep thinker on all things kind of media, digital literacy, programming, etc., he talks about how Instagram has been rolling out this feature, which I don't think we've talked about before. And I don't know if you've seen it, but I don't use Instagram, but it effectively allows you to have a public Instagram account, because a lot of people, especially teenagers, might have a private one because they might get abuse. Let's say your 12-year-old daughter has put a selfie on there. You know, you don't want her, and she doesn't want herself getting comments on her Instagram post saying, "You look really fat," or mm-hmm. something nasty. And so they're basically training artificial intelligence to remove those posts. And the way that they're removing them, Di, isn't... I don't know if you've ever seen shadow banning or heard about shadow banning on Twitter. Shadow banning is where the person who's making the nasty comment or is getting banned, it's to them, it still looks like they've made the comment. So when they view the thread, their comment is still there to them. But for everyone else, it doesn't exist. They have different views.
Oh, okay.
And so, yeah, so Douglas Rushkoff is talking about how that seems like, you know, as a parent, as an educator, that's great. Why wouldn't you want that? But of course, it means that that person doesn't need to change their behavior. And also the person who is experiencing that kind of behavior never has to deal with it or understand the way that the world really is. And I thought that was interesting in the world of social media, because there's a dark underbelly to this, which is you don't need your kid or you don't need to have a private social media account. You can have a public one because you're protecting you. And also that means that you're now subject to adverts and influencers and all of the stuff which makes us money.
Yeah. Yes. So come in, be safe, and yet don't be safe. Be manipulated.
Exactly. Who you're safe from. Yeah.
But again, we go back to that thing of what we said earlier, is that don't blame Google and Facebook for doing what they're doing, because they're just making cash and that's their job, kind of thing. You know, that's why.
But this is why they should be regulated instead of,
I think they should. And I think, I mean, I do hope in time that comes, but I don't think it will come for a while yet.
Yeah. And just lastly on this, because there's so many, I mean, it's going to be fascinating for historians looking back at this period, because as I was explaining to someone at, again, in Geneva, when I did my TEDx talk, I talked about skeuomorphism, which is that design feature which tries to make digital things look like the analog world so that you've got a mental model or a metaphor to understand what it is. In my TEDx talk, I talked about, I think it was on the iPad, Apple had a skeuomorphic design for their calendar, I think it was, to make it look like an actual calendar that you flip in your kitchen or whatever.
Yeah.
And how there's a
dreadful design. Yeah.
No, it was. But there was a definite reason why they did that. And there's a really interesting time when the skeuomorphic design is dropped and how that opens up a whole world of possibilities for understanding the way that technology can really be used. And I think we're at that phase with open badges. Like the badges part is almost we don't need that anymore. We don't need the metaphor of scout badges or certificates, because we understand that digital credentials can do all kinds of things and metadata, et cetera. And the reason I mention that is that there's this wonderful, wonderful blog post on Medium on a blog called Eidolon, and it's by a philosopher. And it's entitled "Plato Would Have Wanted You to Unplug," and the subtitle is "Technology Addiction, Technophobia, and Kids These Days." And I've seen this particularly in private schools, so I'd love your feedback on this. And what they do is they put this veneer of, well, here's the research from psychology, here's what the teenage brain looks like, here's what philosophy says, like this veneer of, well, if you understood things at the level that I understand them, then you'd understand that actually all of this is really bad. And what we need to do is to return to a world of knowledge and classics. And here's what Socrates would have said about this. And basically, this blog post rips it apart and says, you're talking absolute bollocks. What are you actually on about? And quotes Plato and Socrates as they go along. I love it. Absolutely fantastic.
Okay, I'd have to read it.
A long post. Yeah,
those things that you say are obviously part of my life, as in people saying that kind of thing. No one says we need to return to a classics-based curriculum because we already have one.
Exactly.
People do talk about people in my colleagues in my community, my immediate school. Are protective of knowledge. They're respectful of knowledge. They're not outcasting of modern ideas or of different approaches. We're doing curricular review at the moment, looking at different, different uses of project-based learning throughout the school. we do a mixture in my subject, depending on what we're doing. We need to embrace the idea of project-based learning because we're programming, and what is a program if not a project? But I wouldn't argue that we're particularly serious PBLers,
but it's the position that you start from. Like, if you've got a worldview which is threatened by, and this is on all sides of the spectrum. If you've got a worldview which is threatened by something, or if you believe the world to exist in a certain, it's the same reason that people buy and read certain newspapers. Like, if you give someone a media diet, and this is why it comes back to Facebook and social media and something, and things like that. If you give people a media diet of Fox News constantly and nothing else, then their views will get more conservative. And if you give them a diet of, I don't know, the Jacobin magazine or the Socialist Worker or whatever, Guardian, then they'll come out a different way. But what we actually do is we have our worldview, which is formed by all different kinds of things, who we meet, who our parents are, how we were brought up, etc. And then we pick the stuff to read which reinforces those worldviews.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's an interesting thing. Okay, so when I think about knowledge, and I'd be interested in what you think about philosophy in this case. It's not a discipline I've studied. Is it necessary to have studied all the philosophers to be a philosopher? To know the scope, the thousands of years that exist. You know, we're looking at Plato. We talked about Socrates.
That's a really interesting question, Dai. So I think that any philosophy course worth its salt will go. You know, philosophy is often talked about as the history of ideas, and I think that if you went through and picked and chose the philosophers that you focused on, you could really distort, the history of ideas. But the wonderful thing is, if you can spend enough time going through all different kind of schools of thought and how philosophers are built on each other and disagreed with each other and stuff, you realize that everything's just made up. And all of these things that we see as being hard facts and knowledge, etc., is just like what humans, Democritus, who said, by convention hot, by convention cold, but in reality, atoms in the void. And, if I could I'm not someone for tattoos, but if I had a tattoo, I would have that tattooed on my arms. Because it really gets to the crux of what philosophy is about. Like, there are conventions, there are ways of thinking. Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions is another one. Like, there are ways of thinking. William James, and people emphasize different things. But I'd love to read the last three, or maybe you read the last three paragraphs of this article, the Plato would have wanted you to unplug.
Sure, okay, let me get down there. I think it's, let me do that. So far, I've connected this blue screens of death fear-mongering to technophobia, but I think the root cause of this phenomenon is more complicated than that. What we see in this blame screens for how terrible the world is now stance is nothing new. Returning again to the Greeks, the crotchety old dad's Strepsiades, Astrophanes, Aristophanes clouds can't stop bitching about the kids these days and their newfangled chariot racing obsession. But in the clouds, as in real life, bitching about new technology is just something people do when they are actually worried about something else. Technology, in our case, is the scapegoat. And the more we learn about the actual mechanisms behind addiction, the more we can, hopefully, get to the root cause of this societal scourge, rather than scapegoating the substance without which an addict cannot function. After all, if we cling to this primitive idea that an addictive substance must be eradicated, and if we live in a world in which sex and food are considered addictive, where does that leave us as a species? Demonizing the substance rather than the impulse. Behind addiction is what leads us away from true healing and towards damaging narratives. Technophobia isn't a soothing ointment. It's pushing some guy you don't like off a cliff and hoping your pustules magically disappear. That's fantastic.
It is, isn't it? It is, but it's absolutely, but it's right.
yeah, so it is about that. So I'm because I'm an addict and I smoke cigarettes and nicotine and have done for many, many years. And I went to the doctor today, and he said, "Can we talk about your smoking?" And I just said, "Nope, we can't." And he said, "Why?" And I just looked at him like, "I'm not going to answer that question." I said, "I'm thinking about it in the long term, okay." And it's this thing of demonizing it. Demonizing the substance rather than the behavior, and I'm very aware.
Exactly.
Yeah, the impulse is the thing. Is that's what I was asking you earlier about the blog post. Was do you feel an impulse to, because you're getting into a habit of doing something, you feel an impulse to do it? Because I'm struck by my own impulses, like, oh, I want to share that, and then I think actually, no one wants to hear it. So should I be sharing it? And yet I still have the impulse. Should I be acting on this impulse? Where does that impulse come from? And does it really matter anyway? Life is for living. And something's got to kill you.
And that is what philosophy is about. Like, some people say that philosophy is the grown-up version of a kid keeping on asking why until you tell them to shut up. Yeah.
Yes.
So, why is that the case? But why? And people use this in business, like the five whys. You say, okay, we're introducing this new thing. Why? Because we think our customers want it. Why? And you keep on going down like that. And philosophy is basically that until you realize that it's turtles all the way down. Like, it's all made up stuff.
Mm-hmm. So we go back to the original question of. So I would argue whenever I'm thinking about knowledge and schools is that there is a foundation of knowledge that is required before you can that you're adding to. So the learning that you do is in addition to the learning that has gone before you. And the knowledge that you learn is you must have a contextually aware. So if you go back to the reading thing, for me, that's at the basis of the reading. So reading is about putting in your brain, building your knowledge in your brain. And the skills are goddamn wrapped up in it. So is reading a knowledge or a skill? Tell me that. Do you know the answer?
I don't care. I really don't. I find it so boring and so facile that people try and draw a demarcation between knowledge and skills.
I agree. It's a pointless dichotomy. So I think about it. I teach programming, for Pete's sake. It's knowledge and skills wrapped up, and you cannot pull them apart. You just cannot. No.
Talking to someone about this today in a different context. The story of the blind men who were sent to describe an elephant, and they could touch different parts of it, and they described it all differently.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Imagine it's like that, and people going, oh, well, it's all about skills, and some people saying it's all about knowledge, and other people saying, well, it's all about self-development. It's all of that, all wrapped up together, and you're just focusing on different bits of it. Like, what?
This is it, isn't it? And so, I find it that we've had to do in their curriculum review, they're talking about, do you teach knowledge, do you teach skills? Are your skills explicitly listed in your scheme of work? And I just thought, I can't answer that. Just leave me alone. It's like, I teach what I teach that I need to teach. And if the children can do it, then I've done it. Yay. And hopefully they're enlightened by it and they learn. And I don't know. Bollocks.
I mean, everyone focuses in life on things they think are important. And I have to say that endless conversations about whether you're a traditionalist or progressive educator, if there was one thing that I could point to as something that I am pleased that I've left behind on Twitter, it would be that.
I think that's a fair shout. It's just not a very... pleasant debate, but it's one that people repeatedly. I had a conversation last week with heads of department. There was eight of them, and in a meeting discussing teaching and learning, and one of them just pipes up really early on, nice and confidently. First thing he said, it was slating the idea of skills, and I just thought, you're getting on a bandwagon, and it's not okay. You need to be more
exactly.
sophisticated.
It's positioning. What you're doing is you're saying, I'm making a statement, and if this resonates with people, other people, then you're in the in crowd and you're part of my tribe. I was thinking about this when I was in the airport last night. I had to fly from Geneva via Heathrow back to Newcastle. So I was looking at the whiskies in Heathrow, and I was looking at the ones which were like £900. And I was thinking, why do people buy whiskies that are £900? I remembered years ago, I read an interview with Jenson Button in like GQ or FHM or something like that.
One of those, and he was just like,
yeah, those classy publications. And he was saying, if there's a 300 quid bottle of vodka, even though it doesn't taste anything different from anything else, I'll buy it because, you know, that's just the way that the party goes and stuff. And I was thinking, if you kind of extrapolate from, I'm buying this thing which doesn't taste anything different from anything else, you know, and, you know, often people go, oh, look, this £3 bottle of wine from Asda tastes the same as this 300 bottle of wine over here. And you think, yeah, but the reason that people are buying the 300 bottle of wine isn't for the taste. It's for the social status and what it says about them as a person who's buying that wine. And it's the same about our opinions and what we read and whether we identify as being this or that and all of that obvious stuff.
Yes. Yes. No, if you go to a wine tasting, I think it's hilarious. So you go to a wine tasting and you say, why is this bottle of wine £25 and this bottle of wine is £10? Please explain. Mm. And they do explain.
Marketing.
And you think, well, kind of. And there are reasons behind it. You know, it's a particular grape. This grape is hard to process. This is, or this is taken grapes from a single vineyard. This is taken from a single grape from a single vineyard. It's like independent wine production and that kind of, or whatever it might be. You know, there's reasons for it. And I just don't get it. So by the end of the wine tasting, I'm just a bit drunk and confused.
Well, just
and I love good red wine. You know, I really enjoy it.
No, absolutely. But that goes back to the Team Human podcast that I was talking about earlier, and currencies versus currencies. And Arthur Brock, who's a fascinating guy. His website is horrendous, but he's fascinating. In all the stuff he's done, he's set up schools. He's done all kinds of things. But he's talking about how it's only been recently that we've cared about stuff which doesn't actually exist in the product itself. So, for example, we say that, like free-range hens, like the free-rangedness of the hens doesn't exist in the product itself, or the, you know, this is pesticide-free or whatever it is, especially in food. And so these are things which are added in to the product because we care about them and it's part of our identity and it adds to the price point, etc. But it's not part of the actual product itself. And I feel like that exists in all kinds of things in the world, curricula, everything.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair enough. You just got me thinking now about baby animals. So I'm not going to dwell on it. It's just a conversation I'm having about milk and eggs, which I love eggs. I cook them all the time, but I'm just conscious of
veganism.
And I do a plant-based diet and things like that.
Well, I read or I had a conversation with someone and someone said something like, well, of course, the only reason we have honey is because we steal all of the bees' food. I was like, oh.
That's it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a really interesting, as I get older, I don't wish to break the earth much. Do you know what I mean? I want to look after it. And I feel that's a genuine sense inside of me. And that's why I'm sort of contemplating the idea of a plant-based diet. And it's a really strange thing. Gosh, was that me? Oh, it could have been. And did you hear my notification?
No, I didn't. But
it's a notification. You didn't hear it. Okay, that's good.
So in a couple of years' time, you're going to be a no-shoe-wearing vegan...
Or dead.
Guy. Or dead. Yes, probably. Indeed.
So I don't think, no, I don't know. Yeah, this is the thing. I just want to, we pay 2 pence per egg in a boarding house, right? In the school. That's insulting. It's insulting to a chicken. It's insulting to a tree. It's insulting just to the world. It's not okay. I don't get it. And I just think, that, you know, how do I make that okay? How do I reconcile myself with myself about these things as I get older? Now, that's all. I'm just gonna take my midlife crisis right off the table right now. Okay.
I highly recommend having it in advance. I think I had a quarter life crisis, and I'm hoping that that's going to prevent or stave off. Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi. There's a quotation who says that. Well, he says, happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony.
Yeah. God damn, yes. And that's the thing, isn't it? Really, what you need to get under control is your thoughts and understand what they are and why they come, possibly.
Well, I feel like this would be a wonderful place to end this episode of the podcast. What do you think?
I don't see why not, wouldn't it, just? It's gone half past 10 in the night time here.
Cool. So the things we didn't get to, we'll stick these in the show notes, but there's some great things about how you spend your time. Stephen Downs talking about panel sessions at conferences. You put something in about Yuval Noah Harari about the coming artificial intelligence revolution.
It's a lovely 11-minute podcast if you fancy listening to anyone. And the thing that I enjoyed that he said is that I thought was striking was that there's going to be an unworking class, which will be defined by the fact that a person will not be able to earn more money than a machine. So they will have less earning power than a machine and therefore not have any work because the machine will be doing it, which I think is a really, really challenging concept.
Yeah.
That's all. But yes, and what else?
So you've already said what you're doing. So you're breaking up on Saturday for 2 weeks. Is that right?
So I've got 2 weeks off. I have nothing grand planned. I've got lots of little bits of people to see and places to go, and I need to rest. I'm really, really tired. It's the truth that after 6 weeks of school, it's pretty intense, pretty full on. So I need to have some sleep. How about yourself? What are you up to?
Well, I was due to go down to Brighton next week. That might not happen for reasons that I might explain next time. And then the week after, which we'll have to work around, it will be half term for my children and my wife, and we're going away to Gozo again. But I have got, and I'm stretching my arms really wide at this point, this much work to do before then. So I'm just going to be motoring through that, I guess.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. My work's kind of winding down to Saturday when all the children go home. Mm.
Well, I'm solo. I think I've just mentioned that I'm solo parenting because my wife's at a residential with the children. I got back late last night and then she left early this morning. So ships in the night and it'll be 10 days of not really seeing each other. And that's her birthday at the weekend. So yeah, celebrating her birthday, I guess. It's a great time of the year because she's however many weeks older than me. And so I use this part of the year to take the piss about how I'm a toy boy and she's an older woman and all that kind of stuff.
And I'm sure that joke never gets old.
It doesn't. No, not for me anyway.
Well, I hope when we speak next, your marriage is still intact.
Hey, we've been together half our life. We're rock solid. It's all good.
There you go. Well, have a good week. Enjoy.
You too. Cheers, Dave.
Take care, everyone. At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.